Welcome to episode 3 of the Foreign Desk's summer series, in which we're examining historical events as the Foreign Desk might have covered them at the time, working only from the information which would have been available to us. This week, we go back to 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Henry Reece Sheridan, Monocle's New York City correspondent, plays our New York City correspondent. James Rogers, reader in international journalism at City University of London, former BBC Moscow correspondent and author of Assignment Moscow, reporting on Russia from Lenin to Putin, plays our Moscow correspondent. Alex von Tunzelmann, historian and author of Red Heat, Conspiracy, Murder and the Cold War in the Caribbean, plays a foreign policy analyst. Tom Nichols, professor at the U.S. Naval War College with particular expertise in nuclear weapons and the Soviet Union, and author of the forthcoming Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy, appears as an expert on nuclear weapons and the Soviet Union. In our parallel universe, this episode broadcasts on Saturday, October 27th, 1962. On Monday night, US President John F. Kennedy made the gravest statement issued from the White House since Franklin D. Roosevelt, called the day of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor one that would live in infamy. Responding to the discovery of Soviet nuclear missiles being deployed on Cuba, President Kennedy acknowledged, if not threatened, that a nuclear conflict between the US and the USSR is a real possibility. Given the apocalyptic likely consequences of such an event, it is no exaggeration to suggest that we are presently living through not merely the most serious crisis of our time, but of any time. As we go to air, the US has imposed a naval blockade on Cuba to prevent more troops and missiles arriving, and insisted that Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev withdraw what is already there. While no specific ultimatum was attached to that demand, it can be safely assumed that preparations are well underway to remove the missiles by other means. This would mean American airstrikes on Soviet installations on Cuba at least, invasion of Cuba at most, war at best, nuclear war at worst. Is there any peaceful way out of this? Do we know who is making the decisions in Moscow, and to what ends? What does Cuban dictator Fidel Castro think he is playing at? What might happen if Kennedy misjudges Khrushchev, or vice versa? Could this be the last time I get to say, and you get to hear, this is the Foreign Desk?
Он затрагивает вопрос, если говорить, значит, он не процедурный вопрос затрагивает. И председатель, который...
You leave us with some sugar, which of buy sugar. Here, your leaders speak about aggression to Cuba. Khrushchev speak about defending Cuba. You told to take our plane. Khrushchev plane is our plane. Khrushchev is friend.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
It's 5 days since President John F. Kennedy addressed the American people about the Cuban crisis. We will shortly be crossing to New York City for the latest reaction from the US, but before we do that, a reminder of perhaps the key line of a determined, dramatic, and chilling speech.
But now further action is required, and it is underway, and these actions may only be the beginning. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's correspondent in New York City, Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, an absolutely extraordinary statement by the President of the United States, you know, actually, obviously, and unmistakably raising the prospect of an all-out nuclear conflict. How are people reacting to this kind of sentiment being uttered out loud by the man who could order it? Are you seeing any signs of, I don't know, panic buying, hoarding, people leaving town?
As you can imagine, Andrew, there is very widespread concern, and the way that that concern is manifesting in terms of people's behaviour spans a pretty broad spectrum. For most people who are being proactive and choosing to take action in light of the president's statements, their actions are limited to buying non-perishable goods and bottled water at their local supermarket. There are stores reporting that they're running low on these items. Some have completely sold out. At the more extreme end of the spectrum, there are people in New York who have packed their bags and actually migrated north to the Canadian border, possibly intending to cross the border if things heat up over the next few days. And perhaps even further along the spectrum, there are those who both fear the worst, but also want to stay in place. And for those people, there are consumer fallout shelters. Now, consumer fallout shelters have been selling at a pretty good clip since the beginning of the decade, but they've absolutely skyrocketed in sales in the past week. There have been some concerns raised as to the efficacy of these DIY bomb shelters. The physical act of constructing these shelters seems to be slightly more difficult than the salesmen who work for private companies are suggesting. And the Office for Civil Defence, which is the non-military agency in charge of preparing the homeland for a potential chemical attack, has apparently been inundated with public letters this week accounting for failed attempts at shelter construction projects and asking for advice. Some residents in Miami complained that low-lying groundwater had made the evacuation of basements almost impossible. And actually in Ohio, a local farmer, in an attempt to build his own shelter, struck a water pipe, flooded his own home, and created a local water shortage. All of this has amounted to what the Office of Civil Defense Director Stuart Pittman has referred to as a national DIY disaster.
Henry, what you're portraying there sounds either like large-scale optimism or delusion. It's hard to know which. Is there a sense being projected either by official sources or merely by commercial ones trying to sell people stuff while they still can, that some sort of nuclear war would actually be survivable, especially in a city like New York, which you would have to assume is quite high on the Soviet target list?
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that most people are simply taking no action at all, even though, as I mentioned, the concern is obviously widespread. This seems to stem from a understanding that knocking up a hastily constructed home fallout shelter probably wouldn't save them from the fallout of all-out international nuclear war. What seems to be fueling most of the panic buying of fallout shelters are the private shelter companies themselves, who have been doing a roaring trade since the beginning of the decade, selling their wares door-to-door and at large fallout shelter trade shows. The government itself has not endorsed any particular brand of fallout shelter, and I think that their main strategy for mitigating against mass death will be avoiding a nuclear conflict in the first place.
Well, on that subject, we did hear and indeed see another dramatic statement from the administration on Thursday. This was the US ambassador to the UN, Adlai Stevenson, dressing down the Soviets in front of the Security Council. Let's remind ourselves of some of what Ambassador Stevenson had to say after the Soviet ambassador, Valerian Zorin, again denied that there were Soviet missiles in Cuba.
Mr. Zorin and gentlemen, I want to say to you, Mr. Zorin, that I don't have your talent for obfuscation, for distortion, for confusing language, and for double talk. And I must confess to you that I'm glad I don't. But if I understood what you said that my position had changed, that today I was defensive because we didn't have the evidence. to prove our assertions that your government had installed long-range missiles in Cuba. Well, let me say something to you, Mr. Ambassador. We do have the evidence. We have it, and it's clear and incontrovertible. And let me say something else. Those weapons must be taken out of Cuba.
Henry, that does suggest that the administration is keen to maintain a hard line if they have Adlai Stevenson, of all people, talking like that. Do you get the sense that there is solid support for the president from both broader American politics and from the press? Because, of course, you don't need a long memory. In fact, a memory that goes only back to April 1961 and the Bay of Pigs invasion to be able to recall Kennedy getting perhaps a little bit carried away where Cuba is concerned.
Well, in terms of political support, the president summoned congressional leaders from both parties to Washington the day after he gave his speech, and the leaders gave him unanimous backing. In fact, there are plenty of voices in Congress who are advocating for a stronger response and for a military invasion of the island. Now, that doesn't really matter because Congress didn't have much to do with the president's decision-making. Most of the strategizing has been done by Kennedy in consultation with his closest advisers, precisely because he has rejigged the advisory process in light of having his fingers burned so badly in the Bay of Pigs fiasco. Since then, the Kennedy administration has been very careful to instigate a more collegiate, consultatory decision-making process with regards to foreign policy. The permanent foreign policy establishment is, of course, consulted, but they no longer make the final call. That rests on Kennedy's shoulders. In terms of the press's reactions, there seems to be a rallying behind the president's stance and an acknowledgement of the need to get tough on the Soviets in light of this aggression. And there's been a significant amount of consternation directed towards NATO and America's allies for not lending more support, both material and moral and legal, to America faced with this enormous crisis. But the president, of course, has made no bones about America's resolution to act independently if necessary to deter the Soviet threat.
Just finally, Henry, this is, as you have already outlined, a moment of great uncertainty and great fear for everybody in the United States and indeed everybody in the world who has followed the news this week. But for you personally, does it feel like there's any response you can usefully make? Are you making preparations? Have you bought a shelter? Or do you know where your nearest government shelter is?
I have looked at my local nearest publicly accessible shelter, and it's actually just down the road from me here in Queens. Last Christmas, I won a year's supply of Spam at a raffle at my daughter's school Christmas fair, and that was delivered back in January and been stockpiled on my roof since then. I've only been eating one can every other day, so I still have most of it left over, so I'm not going to be engaging in panic buying myself. But there is a significant amount of anxiety in New York as to whether the city has in fact provided enough shelter spaces for all of the residents, many of whom are not officially documented, to fit into.
Henry Rhys Sheridan, thank you for joining us. That was Monocle's New York City correspondent, Henry Rhys Sheridan. Let's look at this now from the other side of this standoff. Joining me now is our reporter in Moscow, James Rogers, and a big hello to anybody at the Lubyanka who may also be on the call. James, first of all, we have just heard from our correspondent in New York about fairly widespread public concern in the United States, not unreasonably, given the stakes delineated by President Kennedy in that speech earlier this week. Are you seeing anything similar where you are in Moscow?
It'd be difficult to describe it as widespread, really, Andrew. I mean, you have to understand the way the media culture works here. To a very large extent, the newspapers, all the official channels, remember, they're all more or less controlled by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, will just follow the government, the Kremlin's line. That said, as you can imagine, in that kind of newspaper culture, that kind of media culture, people get very used to reading between the lines. And in response to President Kennedy's speech, there are these demonstrations. Of course, you know, this is a totalitarian society. People don't just say, right, we're going to organize a demo today. It's rather they're sort of told, I think it's about time the workers from this factory had a demonstration against American imperialism. But we are seeing that. That's officially licensed, of course. So I think to that extent, we can take it that that is the way the public are understanding it.
James, I'm not sure if we have some kind of crossed wire here or if we are in fact being joined by one of your friends at the KGB, but I suppose we should just make the most of this line while we still have it. So let's carry on. Let's take a closer look at some of what the Soviet public are understanding of this crisis. And I guess Pravda, which is, of course, the official newspaper of the Soviet Communist Party, is probably as instructive a place to look as any. Is Pravda reporting this week's events in and concerning Cuba at all? And if so, what are they saying?
We're seeing a very one-sided account of it here, really. It is just that the United States is proposing to blockade. They're not really making the big distinction between quarantine and blockade that has been made in the United States. The United States is proposing to blockade Cuba for no other reason than this. We're seeing headlines like, it's time to rein in the American aggressors who've gone too far. Hands off Cuba, Pravda just said, alongside its masthead, which, if you've ever seen it, Andrew, you'll know it says Pravda, which means truth, of course, in Russian, the organ of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and then two banners of Lenin, the awards that it's won for its coverage in the time. But it's very clear that the United States is to blame for what the official media here see as imperialist aggression.
Well, probably just as important, then, is what Pravda might not be reporting. Is Pravda or TASS or any other Soviet media acknowledging that there are Soviet nuclear missiles on Cuba?
This is the side of the story that we're really not getting in the official Soviet media here. In effect, they're completely denying the presence of any offensive weapons. As my colleague Seymour Topping from the New York Times has put it very succinctly this week when he said, one could not learn from a Soviet newspaper or radio broadcast about the central problem upon which this crisis devolves. So, as I say, people are used to reading between the lines, but in a country where very few people have access to any other sources of information, a lot of this is taken at face value, and a lot of people will be accepting this official narrative that this is all down to imperialist aggression coming from the United States.
I did want to ask about those other sources of information and whether they're getting through at all, whether anybody can tune in to the BBC World Service or the Voice of America. Does any of what they're broadcasting cut through to the general public at all?
It does to a few people. I mean, most of these broadcasts are jammed and they're used as sort of instrument, really, in what we've been pleased to call for the last 10 or 15 years the Cold War. There are some people, English speakers, who are very interested in this, are willing to and do have the shortwave radio receiving equipment, not something that's terribly easy to find here, by the way, either. But there are some people who will be listening to the BBC or to the Voice of America when those broadcasts aren't jammed, but they're not necessarily going to shout about it, so it's difficult to know how many they actually are.
Now, as we said at the top of this program, President Kennedy in the United States has laid out in the starkest possible terms what he believes the stakes are in this situation and what he believes the consequences could well be should the Soviet Union refuse to back down. We therefore need to look at this, I guess, from the perspective of the leadership on the other side of this equation, and that is specifically the curious character of Chairman Khrushchev. What's your understanding of why he has chosen to do this?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, we're talking about what's not in the papers. Izvestia, for example, another of the leading national newspapers here, reported last week that any desire to make a deal linking Cuba to Berlin, you remember still, you know, all the hostilities ended some 17 years ago now after the last war. There's still no official deal there. Berlin is divided. And of course, the Berlin Wall has been a physical symbol of that division between East and West and the way that Germany was left at the end of the Second World War. But there's a denial that that's going on. We've seen some really sort of astonishing undiplomatic conduct in some ways here. just during this week, to the extent that, you know, the United States Embassy tried to present official documents to the foreign ministry here to give the reasons for their quarantine of Cuba, as they call it. Remarkable, though, while these documents were delivered, they were returned unopened just hours later. In other words, the Soviet foreign ministry is saying, you know, we're just not going to engage with this. We're not interested to hear from you at this stage. At least that's what's being put out for public consumption.
What kind of impact on this situation might the personality and temperament of Chairman Khrushchev end up having? Because from what we have seen of him in the West, he does come across as a fairly impulsive, rambunctious, combustible sort of chap. By way of illustration, we have here a clip of him speaking at the United Nations not all that long ago, 1960 this is.
Он затрагивает вопрос, если говорить, значит, он не процедурный вопрос затрагивает. И председатель, который симпатизирует колониальным, этим колониальному господству, он не останавливает его. Разве это справедливо? Господа, господин председатель, мы живем на земле не милостью Божией и не вашей милостью, а силою и разуму нашего великого народа Советского Союза и всех народов, которые борются за свою независимость. Не заглушить вам голос народа, голос правды, который звучит и будет звучать. Конец, могила колониальному рабству. Долой его и похоронить его, чем глубже, тем лучше.
Слава Хрущеву. Сколько храбрости может выступить с такой речью.
And that was Nikita Khrushchev speaking at the UN General Assembly in 1960, followed, I think, by our friend at Dzerzhinsky Square, who is still listening in, apparently. James, my Russian, I'm sure, is not a patch on yours, but there is a fair bit of fairly heavy-duty fire-breathing from Khrushchev there about the grave of colonial slavery, down with him and bury him, the deeper the better, and so forth. Should we be at all concerned that this is the man in charge of making some fairly fundamental decisions about whether or not the rest of us see next week?
There's certainly some pretty strong stuff in there, Andrew. There's a line which was something like along the lines of, we're not here on earth because of the mercy of God or because of your kindness, but because of the strength of the great Soviet people. So he's making it pretty clear where he's coming from. And again, you picked out those other lines at the beginning. I mean, I think if we look back, since Khrushchev became a Soviet leader in 1953 after the death of Joseph Stalin, there have been quite a few surprises and successes in the way that he's led the country. The surprises, of course, you know, you remember it took a while to leak out, but his speech at the 20th Party Congress, in which, to gasp, he denounced the excesses of the Stalin era, and that news of that, of course, eventually leaked out in the West, taking weeks in some cases. But there have been successes if we think about the launch of Sputnik, if we think about the shooting down, of course, of the U-2 spy plane and the capture of the pilot, Gary Powers. This is a leader who has, in many ways, you know, inspired the Soviet people and persuaded them that in this competition with capitalism, socialism, communism is edging ahead. All that said, yes, you're right. I mean, this is a man who survived the Battle of Stalingrad, who was very proud to have fought in that great Soviet victory there. And perhaps, you know, having come from that background, you know, with your country facing an existential threat from a very powerful enemy, maybe it's not too far to suggest that's formed his outlook on life, and, you know, he is willing to take risks and to let people know what he thinks of them.
James, I guess a lot of this is going to boil down to the relatively recently developed field of study known as game theory. Is there a danger that Chairman Khrushchev might find himself pushed into, or having painted himself into, a corner he cannot get out of? Is there a way that he can back down out of this? Can he do that and keep his job?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think he probably can, at least for now. But I think if he does, he's likely to face a good deal of criticism. I think we can certainly see that from other parts of the communist world who variously look to Moscow to provide leadership and inspiration, but also look to Moscow to stand up to who they also would see as Western imperialists, Western aggressors. So I think there will certainly be questions asked if we are managed to get away from, you know, the brink of this terrible crisis upon which we seem to find ourselves. But it is seen, at least publicly, that the Soviet Union has in any way backed down. So I think he's going to need to get some kind of agreement that at least publicly offers him an opportunity to save face. If he does that, he can save his position, as I say, at least for now.
James, we will be talking later in the show about the American chain of nuclear command, and that does, in fairness, seem fairly clear-cut. It's also going to be a very important consideration vis-à-vis how this crisis plays out, and I'm sure it's something they're desperately trying to figure out in the White House right now. Is Chairman Khrushchev actually making the decisions?
I have to be honest with you, Andrew, and it's pretty difficult to know the real answer to that question. You know, we Western correspondents here are really kept at arm's length. You know, we rarely get a glimpse behind the Kremlin curtain, if I can put it that way. But there are some interesting moments. I mean, you may or may not know, you may have read accounts of this. On national days, it's normal here. You know, for example, on the 4th of July, the United States Embassy will entertain the diplomatic and press corps and members of the Soviet Foreign Ministry and the Soviet political establishment. And sometimes, just sometimes, you know, that's in other national days, Khrushchev will actually turn up, you know, and we're there, you know, the hacks sort of chatting away and trying to find out what stories the other correspondents are doing and find out what's going on from the diplomats. And then, you know, he'll come over and have a quick chat with us and we'll get an interview there. And then the kind of thing that, you know, normally the sort of access that will be next to impossible to get. So it's a really sort of interesting way of conducting things, but it doesn't necessarily mean to say that we get a real insight into the way that the Soviet chain of command works.
James Rogers, thank you. That was Monocle's Soviet Union correspondent, James Rogers. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. As we have already learned, it is alarming enough that we have two nuclear-armed superpowers trying to figure out who is bluffing whom. But also at the table is another player who has rarely seemed troubled by the potential consequences of mighty gambles, the Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. Well, joining me now here in London is the analyst Alex von Tunzelmann. Alex, let's start with the figure at the centre of this, i.e. Fidel Castro, leader of the Cuban Revolution. He has been called many things, but rarely a fool. And yet he does seem to be taking the most astonishing risk in allowing these missiles to be parked on Cuba. Castro must understand that if war comes as a result, the optimal outcome is the US invasion of his country, and the worst case scenario is the complete obliteration of Cuba. So what is Castro hoping to gain?
Well, Andrew, what we know from inside is actually that Fidel Castro was incredibly reluctant to take these missiles. I think he has understood from the beginning that this makes Cuba the number one target. I think he really has got himself into a state of feeling that there is a huge world confrontation coming. And in a sense, he's prepared to sacrifice, he certainly says frequently that he's prepared to sacrifice his life. And as we can sort of see now, also the lives potentially of all the Cuban people for this kind of grand gesture in this world conflict between communism and capitalism, as he would see it.
Is it possible that he also sees, though it seems delusional that he could possibly be thinking along these lines, that Soviet missiles on Cuba might actually defend him from the United States? It was only last year that the United States sponsored a counter-revolutionary invasion at the Bay of Pigs.
Absolutely. Well, look, since then, tensions have been ratcheting up and up, and that has been a very notable feature. But I think Fidel Castro is under no illusions, as indeed no one really is who knows the situation, that this is a provocation and a raising of the stakes. So I think the interesting question really from that is what he thinks he's doing here, what kind of end of the world scenario he's really playing out, and is that a bluff or is he actually prepared to do it?
The question of the bluff and the degree to which Castro is that zealous about this, that's still an open one, isn't it? Because it's fair to say that his attitude to the United States has evolved. Even since seizing power in Cuba, it's not axiomatic that he was always going to be an enemy of the United States.
Very far from it, actually. I mean, there are certainly indications that Fidel, in fact, had contacts with the United States. He didn't have contacts with the Soviet Union. In fact, the Cuban Communist Party thought he was a CIA spy and they shopped him to Moscow on that basis. You know, he tried to maintain some kind of balance between communism and capitalism. I mean, he was really explicit about that. I've got a speech here from 1959, just after he came in, May 1959, where he actually said explicitly on Cuban television, our revolution is neither capitalist nor communist. We have been placed in a position where we must choose between capitalism, which starves people, and communism, which resolves the economic problem but suppresses the liberties so greatly cherished by man. Our revolution is not red, but olive green, the colour of the rebel army that emerged from the Sierra Maestra. So actually, he's tried to position himself as a nationalist in between these Cold War poles of communism and capitalism. But as we can see, certainly when the Bay of Pigs happened, that changed very radically. He now has thrown himself in with the socialist camp. And that clearly was because he considered himself under threat.
Is there an argument that the United States, especially since Kennedy came to power, has become perhaps somewhat unhealthily obsessed with Fidel Castro? What do we know other than the Bay of Pigs about other attempts to undermine him or get rid of him entirely?
Well, Andrew, it's all very murky at the moment, and it's very hard to sift the fact from the fiction. But what we do know is that John F. Kennedy and his brother, Robert F. Kennedy, do seem to have a very, very personal enmity for Fidel Castro. And certainly what we can see so far, that really came out of the Bay of Pigs and the disaster there when America tried to sort of put up and support this invasion of Cuba. It went horribly wrong. The Kennedys have certainly been absolutely furious about that. And now, what we do know, for instance, is that since then, this mysterious installation has appeared on campus in the University of Miami, clearly highly well-funded with lots and lots of people. And certainly the rumours are that that is working on schemes to get rid of Castro. We know that there are repeatedly various terrorist attacks within Cuba, you know, bridges being blown up, shops being blown up, bombs and so forth. Certainly the Cubans blame the Americans for that. Naturally, the Americans accept no responsibility. And we do know that there's a lot of very personal enmity in Washington, specifically from the Kennedy brothers against, shall we say, the Castro brothers, Fidel and Raul. So this is a sort of duel of two sets of two brothers that appears to be continuing and becoming incredibly dangerous for the whole world.
Alex, if this standoff is resolved peacefully, as we must all surely hope that it is, the United States and Cuba will still have to have some sort of relationship. Geography dictates that. This is famously 90 miles from Florida. How do you see that panning out? Is Fidel Castro going to be this thorn in the side of successive American administrations, or is Washington best off hoping at this point that Castro's revolution just kind of burns itself out?
Well, Andrew, I mean, that can go various different ways. Obviously, assuming we get past the kind of impending apocalypse this week and it calms down, I think America will probably be very grateful to John F. Kennedy if he does step that down. Now, of course, he's in office till 1964, and almost certainly if he gets past this, I think we can say he would win a second term. There's already talk, of course, that he could be followed by his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who we know is also very ambitious. And who knows, after that, maybe even Ted Kennedy. You know, we could have Kennedys in the presidential office really until about the 1980s, even without generating any more Kennedys. So I think the future of that country does rest very much with their choices and what they decide to do. And we know that JFK in the past has shown leadership and kind of an ability to be a bit of a visionary and talk in terms that move past these kind of petty rivalries. So perhaps he can turn this around, given how much time he has. Maybe there is a chance that he could actually change this conversation and make peace.
Alex von Tunzelmann, thank you for joining us. That was the foreign policy analyst, Alex von Tunzelmann. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Do stay with us. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Finally on today's programme, a look at perhaps the only questions that really matter right now. Who is making the decisions in Washington, D.C. and Moscow? And what happens if they misjudge each other? Well, I'm joined now by the nuclear weapons expert and Soviet analyst Tom Nichols. Tom, let's talk first of all about the stakes that are actually in play here. Obviously, we have some idea of the consequences of nuclear war, but that idea is informed by what happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Terrible though that was, that's not what we're talking about anymore, is it? In the 17 years since then, these weapons have advanced.
No, if things get out of control here, the devastation is going to be incalculable, mostly across the East Coast of the United States, certainly across the Soviet Union, China, Eastern Europe. We're talking about hundreds of millions of people being killed and most of the United States being destroyed.
Is the idea of a limited nuclear war a total fallacy? But of course, as you know, on Kennedy's instruction, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, undertook this big military review in 1961 because Kennedy wanted options other than, as he put it, inglorious retreat or unlimited retaliation. But have we already reached a point at which those are the only options?
The problem is that the number of weapons on both sides now is so large, and the targets they would be aimed at are so close to civilian targets that there wouldn't be any way to tell a difference between a limited war and an all-out nuclear strike. If they go, they're going to hit the Pentagon, and there goes Washington, D.C. Their defense ministry is located dead center in the heart of Moscow. Millions of people will be killed. Cities will be poisoned. The idea that this will be some kind of limited exchange, I think, is a fantasy, and I think Secretary McNamara knows that as well.
Because what you've outlined there is this idea of mutual assured destruction. But if mutual assured destruction works, and of course it is supposed to work by making the prospect of war so terrible that neither side wishes to take that risk, doesn't that depend on both sides knowing exactly what they're dealing with in terms of who is making the decisions on both sides?
Well, I think the assumption on both sides at this point is that everyone involved is a human being who doesn't want to die, and who doesn't want to lose everything in their society and the entire Northern Hemisphere. With that said, I think a certain amount of trust in this interaction between President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev is going to be the only way to get out of this, because they are now in a schedule that is off by many hours, trying to anticipate each other's beliefs and moods and next moves.
Well, let's look at what we know about how those decisions get made and who is making them. We'll start with the easy one, the United States. How clear is the nuclear chain of command? Literally, how does it work?
Nuclear weapons are the president's weapon. It's that simple. Only the president of the United States can authorize the use of nuclear weapons, period, full stop. And when he gives that authorization, that's transmitted to the Strategic Air Command. They execute their missions. In the Soviet case, we think that command and control is split between the army, the party, and the KGB. It's actually, on their side, as far as we know, probably a little more cumbersome than it is here in the United States. And so that there would have to be a bit more agreement among the Soviet leadership. But if things get out of control, I think the Soviets are going to be just as able and willing to go quickly as we are.
But what can we say about how it might influence the thinking of the United States if they have to take into account the possibility that perhaps we will discover many years hence that there actually are right now Soviet submarines near Cuba carrying nuclear weapons, and that the captains have been authorized to launch on their own cognizance?
Well, in that sense, that's why it's easier to deal with the United States. We have a very clear chain of command. On the Soviet side, it's a little more opaque. Are we dealing with just the chairman of the party? How powerful is the chairman of the KGB? It is quite possible that there are submarines loose and on their way to the Caribbean right now that have what we would call pre-delegated authority. If that's true, that's a remarkably dangerous situation.
When President Kennedy addressed the nation earlier this week, he did refer to the balance of nuclear power, and the words he said were that for many years both the Soviet Union, giving credit where it was due there, and the United States have deployed strategic nuclear weapons with great care, never upsetting the precarious status quo which ensured that these weapons would not be used in the absence of some vital challenge. Does the installation of Soviet missiles on Cuba really change the balance of nuclear power all that significantly? I guess what I'm asking is, are the United States' objections to this actually strategic, or are they more political?
Well, if you're talking about the outbreak of nuclear war, the extra missiles in Cuba are just going to bounce the rubble a bit more, although they do reduce the amount of time Washington is going to have to react to anything. One of the things we've seen happen in the last 10 years from the 50s and now into the early 1960s is the move from bombers to missiles, which has reduced the time for decision or reconsideration from hours to, in the case of missiles, minutes. And now with US and NATO weapons close to the Soviet border and with Soviet weapons close to the US border, we're talking about decision times that are going to be reduced to the point where human beings just can't think that fast. Does it change the numerical balance and how many people would die? No. Does it change the political balance and make the Americans in particular more jumpy about having weapons that can reach Miami, New York, Washington in just minutes? Yes, it does.
What do we know right now about what the tensions and differences of opinion might be right now within the White House?
Well, I think we have to assume that the White House is united in rejecting the presence of Soviet weapons in Cuba. The question is the president getting different kinds of advice from different branches of the services? So I think that right now, the White House is probably having some fairly detailed arguments behind closed doors about how to remove these offending weapons without actually having to engage in military action against actual Soviet military personnel in Cuba. But there are probably differences of opinion among the military services about the best way to do that.
Well, just finally, Tom, as somebody who probably understands more about the dynamics of nuclear deterrence and the Soviet Union than most people in the United States in 1962, how worried are you personally right now?
I'm scared to death, to be honest. This is not a good situation. This was a surprise. Leaders with nuclear weapons probably, as a rule, shouldn't try to surprise each other with moves like this. And this is starting to grind down to a confrontation that is going to involve not only nuclear weapons, but saving face and reputation and the loyalty of allies. Neither side can really afford to be humiliated here, but somebody's going to have to back down or we're going to face a catastrophe unprecedented in human history.
Tom Nichols, thank you very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. And that's it for this week's episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, we hope. The final installment of our historical summer series will look at the Iran hostage crisis of 1979, and of course look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. Special thanks this week to Monocle's Paige Reynolds for her role as a put-upon KGB agent who is clearly in need of a holiday. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.